Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Today's episode is titled Changing the Narrative on Urban Refugees, and I am delighted to welcome Dr. Lucy Earle, who is the Interim Director of the Human Settlements Group at the International Institute for Environment and Development. Lucy's work focuses on the intersections of urbanization, urban poverty, and humanitarian crises, in particular forced migration into and within urban areas. Lucy leads the Institute's research and policy engagement on urban crises and the interface between the environment and humanitarian action. She also has a background working on low-income housing, urban citizenship, and the right to the city in the Global South. She's currently leading a GCRF-funded project on protracted displacement, comparing the well-being and livelihoods of displaced people in camps with those in urban areas in Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Jordan, and Kenya. Prior to joining IIED, Lucy was an urban advisor to the UK's Department for International Development, where she spent 3 years seconded to the International Rescue Committee to implement DFID's Urban Crisis Program. In this role, she was involved in global advocacy on urban crises centered around the World Humanitarian Summit and Habitat 3. She co-convened a series of consultative spaces designed to bring together networks of mayors, built environment professionals, urban development specialists, and humanitarian actors to build a common understanding of how to improve responses to humanitarian crises in towns and cities. She also has a PhD in development studies from the LSE and has completed a postdoctoral fellowship at the African Center for Cities at the University of Cape Town. She recently also finished an MSc in urban planning through distance learning at the University of the West of England. Welcome, Lucy.
Thank you for having me.
We are really delighted that you could join us today. I wanted to start by asking you about your recent project. So in this project that you've had findings from a large comparative study of camps and urban areas in which you have focused on well-being, right? So could you talk us through some of the findings?
Yeah, sure. So this is a mixed method study. There's a survey in each of the four countries that you mentioned in the introduction with around 900 refugees and hosts in each country, split across camp and urban areas. And there's also qualitative work as well. And there's a split focus to the project. There's a livelihoods component that's being run by colleagues at the University of Cardiff. And then at IID, we're running the well-being component. And this is, I suppose, a kind of something that's become very personally interesting to me, to try and broaden how academics, but also practitioners, policymakers, conceptualize well-being for refugees. So the data that often gets collected around displaced people, whether in camp or urban areas, is often focused on very basic needs, on food, shelter, access to healthcare, I guess education in some circumstances, depending, I suppose, on the phase of the emergency. But it's about kind of sustaining a minimum of existence. And in this project that we're doing at IID that's focused on protracted displacement, so more than 5 years in displacement, we kind of felt that it's time to move on from this kind of emergency keeping people alive phase to thinking about what is a good life for somebody in exile. And so there we really drew on the work of the Wellbeing and Development Group in Bath that was done in the 2000s. It was a big research project funded by DFID at the time that looked into what sort of the meanings people have around having a good life, what it means to live well. And we realised that that hadn't been applied to displacement settings or humanitarian settings in general, certainly not with field research. There have been a few studies that use similar methods, but we're using sort of existing data, so secondary data. And we came up with these five dimensions of well-being. We talk about bodily well-being, so physical health, nutrition, shelter, the kind of things you'd probably expect, feeling safe. Then economic well-being, about having an income, about levels of debt. You get the idea. Social well-being looks at leisure and networks, being able to spend time with friends. And that's actually the kind of thing that people, refugees, don't often get asked about, actually, when they're being surveyed and vulnerability assessments. Political well-being, so not being able to vote, but whether or not you feel there's someone who represents you, do you have access to justice? And then finally, psychosocial well-being, about how you feel about how you're doing in life, whether you have hope and aspirations. Again, that's something that refugees often don't get asked about. So we have now got some findings between the camp and the urban. So the comparison is within each country, between the camp and the urban. We can compare across the four countries as well, but the main focus was to understand the difference. And we did, as a group of urbanists, we were hoping that the data would show that life in cities is generally better than life in camps. As you know, refugee camps are not great places to live, and yet humanitarian funding gets poured into them. And often refugees in cities get almost no aid. But we wanted to see, like, despite this, what are levels of well-being looking like between the camp and the urban? And it's not actually as clear-cut as we thought. So in two of those dimensions, it is pretty clear. So on the bodily well-being and on the economic well-being, refugees in cities are doing much better. And in camps, refugees are often going hungry. And that is, to me, really shocking, in that the camps are being maintained by international humanitarian assistance, and people are not really supposed to leave them, and yet they're not being given enough to eat, and they can't work, and they won't necessarily have enough land to do subsistence farming. So people are going hungry in our survey over the previous 7 days. On the other aspects, on the social well-being, that's really interesting because it shows that people in camps do have decent social networks, which is not all that surprising. You're generally quite a homogenous group of people. You're living with people who've been through a similar trauma to you, who may be... Probably there'll be people of your ethnic group or, you know, extended family members. But it does also point to how difficult life can be in urban areas for refugees in terms of feeling isolated and not having networks. And then political well-being is kind of similar in the sort of being able to feeling that there are people who represent you, that you can get access to justice. I mean, that was, I guess, not so surprising that that might be more difficult in camps. The picture's not all that clear. It just varies from country to country. And then on the psychosocial well-being, well, that one we were surprised at. We thought that life would be much more depressing in a camp than a city. But actually the stresses of life in the city mean that some people are not having they're not having great levels of mental health in urban areas. So as well as sort of pointing out some of the real deficiencies of camps, is the study is also showing where there are big gaps in support for refugees in urban areas. So that's just a snapshot, and we're going to be having lots of publications coming out this year, policy briefs, working papers, academic publications, probably more like next year.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. Let me also then push you on this question around justice, which I think is really interesting as well. And this is something that I have been interested in from when I first started my research. Do people get justice in the camps and in urban environments when they are categorized as refugees or displaced people? And what kinds of issues are we looking at when we're looking at these questions around justice?
So this is the data from the survey. So they're sort of quite broad questions about, do you feel you have access to justice? Can you speak to someone? Can you speak to the police if you feel you're in danger or something's happened? And I think in camps, there are a range of mechanisms that people can access. So there are camp management committees. There will be representatives of NGOs and the international community around. There are also, particularly in the SETA, we found this from the qualitative work, there's people reproduce community resolution, sort of conflict resolution mechanisms from back home within the camp. So I think we do have some qualitative data on people talking about traditional methods of resolving differences and traditional sort of leadership structures being sort of transplanted or recreated within the camp. In the urban area, I think that the relationship with the police can be very difficult in some cities, and I think that's certainly the case in Nairobi. I mean, it's not to say that your average Kenyan has a great time with the police either, but I think there's a lot of fear from refugees of the police, particularly the Somali community, who are there's a lot of stereotypes about them all being very wealthy and refugees being wealthy, and there's a lot of extortion and bribery, I think, going on in Nairobi. So there, I haven't actually looked at this in detail, we're at the stage where we're sort of finding the big patterns and then digging into the data. But I think we'd probably see some quite negative attitudes towards the police amongst survey respondents in Nairobi. I'm afraid that in Jordan we weren't allowed to ask any questions about the police.
You weren't allowed to ask questions about the police?
We were asked to remove certain things from our survey before we could conduct it.
Okay.
So I think that there isn't that question about trust, having trust in the police. I don't think we were allowed to ask that question. I can't remember. But interestingly, in some of the qualitative data, people talk very warmly about how they've been treated by the police in Amman and how they might have been picked up, but then the police have just driven when they've been selling something on the street or something, and the police have just driven them home. Rather than, you know, they haven't, there are actually some anecdotal stuff in our qualitative interviews about being treated very fairly by the police in the city. So it's funny that the authorities didn't want us to ask any questions, because actually they might have got some quite positive feedback from the refugees.
What do you think the impact of your research is going to be on humanitarian policy or on these institutions that create policy or provide aid? If any?
Well, that's an incredibly difficult question to answer, and it's something I struggle with a lot, having been a civil servant within DFID, where there's, at the time, there was money and there was, I guess, prestige associated with being in DFID, and UN agencies and NGOs listened to DFID. And it's very different being in research. You can produce, you know, top quality research, but just getting it in front of a policymaker or decision maker in a UN agency, that's a battle. And, you know, just being able to talk or present, get your data in front of people who can make decisions is one thing. And then for them to then go away and read your work and then make a decision based on the evidence that you've provided. I mean, I don't know how often that happens. I think it's more that there needs to be a sort of a build-up of a change in the way that people are writing about refugees, and this kind of idea of changing the narrative. It's quite a long, I think it's probably quite a long-term process, and I don't think with this one project we're going to have sort of immediate impact. But I would hope that we start to open up the way that people think about refugees and where they, this idea of where they belong. Because there has been this narrative about refugees belonging in camps, and even now when refugees in cities are struggling and they might go to the UN and request assistance, I'm afraid they're still told, if you can't manage in the city on your own, then you need to go back to the camp. We need to go and register in a camp. And that's even when the UN Refugee Agency has an alternatives to camps policy and an urban policy that is supposed to be providing and options and supporting people outside the camps. But there's a very strong culture of, well, if you can't make it in the city, you have to go back to the camp, because if you're in the city, then you have to be self-reliant and you have to look after yourself. And I think that's a big problem. A lot of people don't want to live in the camps, and they can have more productive, more normal lives in a city or a town or a village even, you know, it doesn't have to be living in the big city. But they would need some support to begin with, to start off a new life in this way. But at the moment, that isn't the way that the big agencies think. The camp is still very much part of policy. It's a bit of a knee-jerk reaction when you have a big refugee inflow. But you have to, because you have to deal with large numbers of people arriving. But no one flicks the switch and says, right, the emergency phase is over. Now we need to start emptying the camps and these people need to go and live somewhere more suitable. That never happens. And so you keep the camps for decades and they become degraded, the infrastructure becomes degraded. there's always this tension about whether or not you make the infrastructure more permanent, given that it's meant to be a temporary solution. And then people live in really poor circumstances, in generally quite inhospitable places, for decades. And I think that's really problematic, and that's when you see the poor nutrition, because there isn't the money and there isn't the donor interest. And so you've got this, you're keeping people in this sort of really quite depressing situation. And that's why we thought that with our psychosocial well-being that people would be having a worse time in the camps. But I also think someone pointed out to this to me, there's this question of like adaptive preference. Because if you ask people like, how would you rate your life in the camp? Most people say, oh, it's fine. But if you say to them, do you think you should be shut in this place and not able to move about? They're like, no, of course not. And in the qualitative work, people talk about feeling suffocated. There's one woman who talked about feeling that life in the camp was like living in a bottle with the oxygen circulating round and round and round and diminishing. So when you ask people to talk about their aspirations, about what they'd want, they don't want to be in the camp. But if you ask them a question in a survey, like, how do you rate your life? They're like, oh, it's okay. Can't complain, because you're asking people to sort of talk about what's possible, and they know that they probably can't go and live outside the camp, either because they can't leave or they know they haven't got the money to get themselves set up to begin with. So that the question on the sort of the psychosocial stuff is interesting, and yeah, there's a lot going on when you ask people to sort of rate their existence. There's all sorts of things that will have a bearing on how they answer that question.
It makes me want to think about why and questions around political will. You know, we know that the UNHCR's urban policy, you know, has been around since 2009. And it's a bit surprising that we are well over a decade since, and these kinds of questions around well-being haven't come up. Why haven't they come up? And coming back to this point that you were making about doing the research but actually putting it in front of someone who's actually responsible for making policy and trying to get them to change the narrative is really difficult. Again, it comes back to this question of why and what is the issue around political will. And I'm asking you this as someone who's worked as a civil servant. I think many of us will probably have the answers in our own ways, and, you know, we can tell you why we think that's the case. But I'd like to get your perspective on this as someone who has been in that civil service space and also someone who's doing that research to try and get policymakers to change that. Like, why haven't they done this already? And why do they not want to do it?
Well, there are all sorts of different answers to that question. And I worry about saying that no one's looked at well-being before. But well-being can be classified conceptualized in many, many different ways. But sort of this idea of sort of living a good life and supporting refugees to live a good life, I don't think that's the way most people talk. There's all sorts of reasons. I think, you know, humanitarians, what they do is they respond in emergencies. They keep people alive. That's what they do. It's what, you know, save lives, preserve dignity. And they do that by making sure people have enough to eat, that they have a roof over their heads. The basics, right? The water, sanitation, healthcare. Yeah. And that's what they know how to do, and they do it very well. And it's this problem with, like, the not knowing when to stop and say, we shouldn't be doing this anymore. We need to move on. But also because if you've created a camp, you've created people in it dependent on you. And so if you just go away, leaving them in the middle of nowhere, and who's going to respond? Who's going to look after them? And then you might be in danger of a host government saying, well, if the UN's not going to feed these people, they can go home because we're not going to feed them. And so there are all sorts of reasons why keeping a focus on the basics and keeping your head down as a humanitarian and not sort of pushing the government to do something different, i.e. maybe to think about hosting refugees within, you know, local communities, you can carry on saving lives and preserving dignity because you're going to keep people alive in a camp. And so maybe that's one reason it's simpler. talking about well-being is difficult. So a humanitarian professional, when he heard about this research for it, I'd started it, but I was introducing it to him because we knew we'd got the funding. He said, oh my God, do we also have to think about well-being? I said, that's just another thing we have to add onto the list. And his colleague was in the room was like, well, yeah, these are human beings. And maybe some people don't see refugees as human beings so much as populations that need to be warehoused. There's this whole debate around this. They're like, they're just numbers. Michel Lagier talks about this as well, right?
Yes.
They're these kind of people on the margins. We just stick them in a camp and don't forget about them and also basically keep them alive. I think there's also, I'm afraid, financial incentives for setting up camps. It creates jobs. It's in the UN and the NGO system. It brings funding in. Angelina Jolie can go and visit a camp and bring in money. If she's just wandering the streets of Nairobi talking to poor people who look like all the other poor people, I don't see that. Just that's probably not going to get the tills ringing in the UNICEF fundraising office. Sorry, that's very cynical of me, but I think that's also true. It's a visible thing. You can show the world that you're doing something about the refugee crisis in the country by saying, look, we've put these people over here, and we're going to make sure the UN looks after them, and we're also going to make sure they don't come and take your jobs or start pushing up property prices, but if they move into towns and cities. So there's so many reasons why people don't want to think about the more complicated question of what would a good life look like, which for me would be having freedom of movement, being able to get a job if you can work, being able to make the most of your life, which means not being in a camp, or at the very least, if you're going to be in a camp-like place, it's open and it's near to opportunities and you can move around and go into the city during the day and come back. Living a good life probably means the end of the camp. And there's so many incentives for camps.
So I'm coming back to this point you made earlier about knowing when to stop. Right? That humanitarians are very good at providing emergency support when a situation arises. But at some point, they need to know when to stop and move away. But with a lot of the durable solutions work, it feels like it continues the support for an indefinite period of time. So the humanitarian work is simply evolving into this kind of humanitarian development nexus, which is exactly what they talk about. That it's sort of humanitarian, it's development work within a humanitarian context, which is sort of a humanitarian, sort of a development issue at this point.
But if you have people in a camp, I'm not sure how you can ever have a durable solution. Because most of the time, where camps could never be sort of self-sufficient towns and cities because of where they're sited, i.e. far away from places of trade and industry, purposely sited in quite remote places. On the durable solution side, I mean, a radical thing to say would be that humanitarians should never get involved in displacement crises. You could instead give upfront loans and grants to receiving countries to distribute to refugees so they can go and live wherever they want. You could say to cities around the country, okay, well, you're going to have a certain quota, and we're going to bolster your budget by X amount, and the refugees will get this amount in aid to live a different type of life. I mean, I can't see that ever happening, really. I mean, complicated. But why not see if we could move a little bit more in that direction by, instead of sort of creating this parallel world for refugees, we think right from the start, what would they need to live for as long as necessary in this country without being too much of a burden on like basic services. But because this is a point that we're trying to look at in another research project, we're trying to find out what a camp costs over the years, looking at just one camp in Jordan and trying to find costs, which is almost impossible. Because my wonder is, like, if you know, in 2012, the humanitarian community had been able to say, okay, well, camps generally exist for X number of years, and during those number of years, this is what gets spent on them. Would you like that money up front to invest in your towns and cities, in your infrastructure, in improving your services? Do you really want us to go and literally pour that into the desert and truck water to ridiculous numbers of kilometres, be trucking waste around the country, you know, putting a camp in a desert in a water-scarce country? Do you really want us to spend billions and billions of dollars doing that when we could probably help improve the water supply in some of your major cities for the benefit of everybody? No one is having those conversations at the start of a displacement crisis. And if there's one thing I should change with our research, I'd like one day that we at least have the data to be able to have that conversation. Right now, no one can say it. No one can go up and no one can say to a hosting government, this is how much it costs to keep a refugee family over for a year, 5 years, 10 years, projections about how they might start being able to earn their own money, if they're given rights to work, etc., etc. No one's like dangling that carrot of big, large investments of funding in the country at the start of a refugee crisis. No one's doing that. And it's probably, people will disagree very strongly with that idea. I think it's impossible, politically impossible. But I don't think anyone's having those conversations.
That is a really radical idea. I think it's really interesting. And I think it'd be really interesting to see if a conversation could be started around that. So I guess I should probably also ask you, for my own interest, do you think humanitarians should be working in urban environments to support refugees?
Yeah, there's certain things they can do. They do have a role. They do have a role in terms of understanding particular vulnerabilities. Refugees, there's always the protection issues around registration, documentation. Like, yes, of course there's a role. But it's relatively limited, I would say. And that's challenging as well. And it's been hard for the UN Refugee Agency to implement its own urban policy and its own alternatives to council policy because it's so different to what it does on a daily basis. Mm. And working out what the relationship should be with a municipal government, for example, is complicated for an agency that historically has only ever dealt with national level government. And as we know, you know, often big cities might have you know, mayors or governors who are from a different political party from the federal government or the national government. And so then that might cause all sorts of issues for a UN body to be able to negotiate at those different levels around access to services for refugees and so on. So it's not simple, but there's a lot of thinking that hasn't been done yet about what this might look like.
Yeah, definitely a lot of thinking that needs to be had. Can I just ask you a last question in closing, which is, again, coming back to this point that you have a lot of experience in this policymaking world and going on the last point that you made, what do you think is missing? Like, what do you think needs to be done to push for a more urban agenda or more of a focus on the urban in this global humanitarian agenda-making space?
I think there's progress happening in giving mayors the opportunity to talk about how they respond to displacement and their potential role. And I think that's quite new and quite promising and has been a missing piece. And, you know, often mayors can be quite progressive. Mayors of big cities around the world have been very vocal about supporting refugees in recent years. And I think the more that they can engage at the international level, but also at national level, on what a response should look like, I think that piece is kind of missing in a lot of places. So what you often find if you speak to somebody working in a city government, if you try in, for example, Amman or Nairobi or Addis, three of the cities where we're working, they'll say, well, obviously refugees have access, have rights to certain services, but you know, really refugee issues, that's dealt with at a national level by the security services, by the office of the Prime Minister, for example. It's generally held at a much higher level. And what's starting to shift a little bit is recognition amongst city officials themselves, actually, that they do have a role to play. There are lots of people coming into the city who have particular needs. This could be humanitarian funding for those people. City government does need to have a say in policies around displacement, but that doesn't happen in this country, I don't think. I don't think it's, there's laws of displacement, but that doesn't happen. But I think that's a big piece that's missing. And there's some great people around the world trying to push for that. But the UN's not very well set up for that either. If you want a funny anecdote, there was some cities conference happening, and national governments didn't want mayors to be allowed to be on the delegation list. And it was like an urban event. I can't remember where it was, but it was like, this sort of goes to show that the sort of protocols around international policymaking are very, you know, they're not open to subnational governments being part of it. So I think that's one thing that's missing. But there's progress there.
Yeah. I think you made a really, really important point there. I mean, so many powers are not decentralized. And with these kinds of issues around refugees and displacement, those powers are still held very centrally. And that does create an issue, because municipal governments, at the end of the day, whether it's a small municipality or a big city, are the ones who are facing the issue. Well, thank you for that fantastic discussion. It was really, really interesting. I know that we could have talked for much longer, and I know that you've given us a lot to think about, and there are lots of really interesting ideas over here. And I can't wait to see all the outputs from this project. Sounds really, really great. So thank you again for coming and chatting with us in the midst of your busy schedule.
Thank you, Romola. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.